Hey, I'm Steph, and this is Not Today. Hello and welcome, or welcome back. Before we jump into our case for the week, I wanted to let you know that bonus episode number 54 is out now over on our Patreon. We're talking about 21-year-old Brady Lowry and his Northwest College wrestling teammate, Kendall Cummings, who were mauled by a grizzly bear while shed hunting. The bear attacked Brady first, and when Kendall saw the bear, he jumped in and tried to pull it off of his friend, but the grizzly turned on Kendall and mauled him as well. It's a pretty incredible story, as are all of the bonus episodes we have over on Patreon, because our patrons get to vote on the stories they want to hear, so they're all very interesting. So head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast to get access to all of our bonus episodes and more. But the case I'm going to be diving into today has so many twists and shocking details, so buckle up. In 2000, 15-year-old Heather Robinson learned that her adopted parents were not legally her parents, and her real name wasn't even Heather. The man who facilitated her adoption when she was only 4 months old had actually murdered her biological mother, and that man was still very much in her life. Heather's life was turned upside down when she learned that her Uncle John was a serial killer and had taken the lives of at least 8 women, her mother included. John Robinson has been referred to as the internet's first serial killer. His criminal career is extensive and violent. He is one of the boldest criminals in recent history, and yet if you saw him on the street, you'd probably think nothing of him. He knew how to blend in well and was very charming, which is one of the things that made him so dangerous. This case contains graphic details that may be distressing to some. Listener discretion is advised. John Edward Robinson was born on December 27, 1943, in Cicero, Illinois, just outside of Chicago, and grew up in a working-class neighborhood. He was the third of 5 children to Henry and Alberta Robinson. His father was reportedly an abusive alcoholic, and his mother was a strict disciplinarian. However, despite his harsh parents, John had an ordinary childhood. He loved animals, he was an Eagle Scout, and got along well with everyone. When he was a young man, he made a trip to England with his Eagle Scouts, where he sang for the Queen of England. He performed for the Queen of England at the Palladium in London when he was only 13, and backstage at the Palladium, he ran into Judy Garland. Judy Garland kissed John Robinson on the cheek, and there was a photo taken, and that picture made the Chicago papers. Which is such a wild way to start this story, and definitely not what I was expecting when I looked into this case. There is actually a picture of him getting kissed on the cheek by Judy Garland, and he just looks like this cute little boy who's beaming, because of course he is, and anyone who looked at that picture would have no idea who this little boy would become in the future. He became an evil, violent predator, and yet that was how he came off to everyone around him. Like he was an innocent, cute boy, and later on, a very charming, unassuming man. John enrolled at Quigley Preparatory Seminary in Chicago to become a priest, but dropped out after only 1 year due to disciplinary issues. School records showed that he was a poor and failing student and frequently got involved in fights with his classmates and spent much of his time in detention, so he gave up on the idea of becoming a priest. Which makes sense. John was not a very good and holy man. He would actually become the complete opposite. And in 1961, Robinson enrolled at Morton Junior College in Cicero to become a medical radiographer, but dropped out after 2 years. And in 1964, he was 21 years old when he moved to Kansas City and met a woman named Nancy Jo Lynch. They'd be married for decades and decades. She gave birth to their first child, John Jr., in 1965, followed by their daughter Kimberly in 1967, and twins Christopher and Christine in 1971. So John quickly became a family man. But underneath it all, he was a con man. He got a job at a Chicago hospital as an X-ray technician in 1966 under Dr. Wallace Graham by forging his credentials. And he immediately began stealing money from the hospital. Dr. Graham happened to be Harry Truman's personal physician, and Dr. Graham described John Robinson as a people person. He smiled a lot and gave an excellent first impression, but he had a darker side to him. It was found out that he had embezzled $33,000 from Dr. Graham, and that wasn't the only time. He had a very long career as a con man. He also had multiple affairs with office staff and some patients. He had sex with one of the patients in the x-ray lab, claiming his wife was terminally ill and unable to accommodate his needs, which is gross. Meanwhile, he's embezzling tens of thousands of dollars from this practice, and the unexplained loss of revenue prompted an audit of the practice's books, and that pointed to Robinson as the point of embezzlement. He somehow was able to come off as somewhat sincere as he made up some story, and basically just got a slap on the wrist. He was only sentenced to 3 years of probation for that crime. But the following year, he violated his probation by moving to Chicago without his probation officer's permission and gained a job as an insurance salesman at the R.B. Jones Company. In 1971, he was arrested for embezzling funds once again and was ordered back to Kansas City, where his probation was extended. And in 1975, Robin's probation was extended again after an arrest on charges of security fraud and mail fraud in connection with a phony medical consulting company he had formed himself. John was always stealing from someone. Every time he was caught for these white-collar crimes, he somehow always managed to escape any real significant punishment. He would remain on probation for nearly two decades, but that didn't stop him from being the monster that he was. Part of the reason he was able to get away with his crimes for so long was because he didn't look dangerous. John Robinson was compared to the Pillsbury Doughboy. He didn't look like a con man and a mass murderer. He was somewhat attractive and charming. He smiled a lot and laughed. He told good stories and presented himself as a really good guy. Robinson even became a scoutmaster for his kids, a baseball coach, and a Sunday school teacher. In 1977, he was named to the board of directors of a local charitable organization. He forged letters from its executive director to the mayor of Kansas City, which resulted in him being named the organization's Man of the Year. That year, there was a banquet held in downtown Kansas City at one of the hotels, and they announced that the Man of the Year was John Robinson for all his great work. But this turned out to be something that John himself had come up with. There was no Man of the Year award. He created it. He nominated himself, and he bought his own plaque and held a banquet to celebrate himself. He sounds like a real peach to be around. And after completing his probation in 1979, John was once again arrested for embezzlement and check forgery, which he served 60 days in jail for in 1982. After he was released, he formed a bogus hydroponics business and stole $25,000 from a friend of his, who he promised a fast investment return so that this friend could pay for his dying wife's medical care. Which is just awful, but somehow he managed to keep up the appearances that he was this good guy and not doing anything wrong. I don't know how, because he's stealing tens of thousands of dollars from pretty much everyone, including his friend who has a wife who's dying and needs medical care. But that didn't matter to him, he just wanted the money. Everything was about John Robinson, he's the Man of the Year. He wasn't living a double life, he was living five different lives. He was the father of four children with his wife. He was trying to present himself as a family man. He was friends with his neighbors, the referee at his kids' soccer games, an elder at their church, and their scout leader. He was the last person you would expect to be committing all of these crimes, and it would only get worse. Steve Hames was Robinson's probation officer, and he could see right through him. He had his eye on Robinson for a very long time, knowing that something well beyond white-collar crime was happening here. There was no doubt in his mind that Robinson was up to no good, he just didn't have the proof yet. And unfortunately for him and everyone involved, Steve Hames was right about that. In 1984, Paula Godfrey, who was only 19 years old, answered an ad in the paper for a job, to work as a sales representative for Robinson's new management consulting firm, Equi2. John had established two more fraudulent shell companies and hired Paula. She was interested in pursuing a career in business and told her family that John Robinson had arranged for her and a group of women to fly to San Antonio, Texas to enroll in a clerical skills course. Robinson picked up Paula at her residence in Overland Park, Kansas on September 1, 1984, to drive her to the airport for her flight. And after that, she disappeared. After hearing nothing from her, her parents filed a missing persons report. Her father also confronted John Robinson, who denied knowing anything about her disappearance. And then all of a sudden, these typewritten letters started appearing, signed by his daughter, saying, "I'm fine, you don't need to worry about me," with Paula's signature at the bottom. The letter also thanked Robinson for his help and asserted that she was okay and did not want to see her family. At first, Paula's father was relieved to get a letter from her and know that she was alive, but upon closer look, he noticed it didn't really sound like his daughter. But because of these letters, the investigation was terminated, since Paula Godfrey was of legal age and there was no evidence of wrongdoing. The letters didn't sound like his daughter, but her signature was at the bottom, so there was really nothing they could do. And sadly, no trace of Paula Godfrey has ever been found. John was very good at choosing his victims. They were all looking for some way out of poverty or their problems, and he promised them the world. But not long after that, Robinson assumed the alias of John Osborne and met 19-year-old Lisa Stassi and her 4-month-old daughter, Tiffany, at a women's shelter called Hope House. Lisa Stassi was a young woman in a difficult marriage to a man named Carl Stassi. Lisa was a beautiful girl, originally from Alabama, and met Carl in 1984. She quickly became pregnant, and they decided they wanted to get married and keep the baby. But Carl was struggling to find work, and they began having real problems in their marriage. According to Lisa's aunt, Karen Moore, by Christmas of 1984, Lisa said she and Carl had a big fight, and she didn't know where to go or what to do. And that was when Karen took her to Hope House. The Hope House was a residential facility that housed about 25 women and children at a time. And at the same time, John Robinson had started the Kansas City Outreach Program, which was supposedly a program designed to help downtrodden young mothers. Through that phony philanthropic effort, he was introduced to Lisa, who was in a very tough spot in her life. Robinson presented the program to Lisa as a way to receive free room and board while studying for her GED. He promised her a job and a stable living situation in Chicago in exchange for signing several sheets of blank stationery. Incredibly shady stuff. He ended up putting her up at the Roadway Inn Motel and checked her into room 131 in early January of 1985. And at some point, Lisa had left the Roadway Inn and, of course, taken her baby with her, and John became frantic to find her. She was at her sister-in-law's house, Kathy Klingensmith. Lisa was telling Kathy about John, telling her Mr. Osborne arranged to pay for their new accommodations. But Kathy said she felt uneasy about this setup. That night, there was a blinding snowstorm, and the city was paralyzed. John Robinson showed up at Kathy's house and told Lisa they had to leave right now and get out of there. So he loaded Lisa and Tiffany into his car, leaving behind Lisa's car, her clothes, baby food, diapers, and with basically nothing left, she went back to the Roadway Inn. When she got there, she called her mother-in-law and told her John wanted her to sign some papers. There were 4 of them. Betty Stassi told Lisa not to sign anything. Lisa, on the other line, was crying before she finally settled down and said, "Oh, here he comes now," and then she hung up. And that was the last time Betty or anyone heard from Lisa. She just disappeared. And just like Paula, people in Lisa's family began receiving typewritten letters from Lisa. One said, quote, "I want to thank you for all your help. I have to get away from this area to make a good life for me and Tiffany." It said she got in contact with some really nice people who helped her with everything, and she and Tiffany were leaving Kansas City. Lisa's family definitely felt like this was not from Lisa. She was not a letter writer, and she had never done that before. They didn't know what happened to Lisa or Tiffany, but the more time that passed, the more they started feeling like they may not be alive anymore. But baby Tiffany was alive, and 15 years later, she would learn the truth about her identity. Robinson was a 9-to-5 serial killer. He committed all of his crimes during the day because at night he was at home with his wife and kids, and later his grandkids, eating dinner and watching TV. And by the late 80s, even more women went missing. In January of 1987, 27-year-old Catherine Frances Clampett left her child with her parents in Wichita Falls, Texas, and moved to Kansas City to live with her brother's family and find employment. She saw an advertisement for Equi2, a management consulting firm in Overland Park, Kansas, shortly after her arrival, which promised extensive travel and even a new wardrobe. Robinson hired her, and Catherine began staying at several local hotels near the Equi2 offices. And on June 15th, 1987, Catherine Clampett left to have a meeting with John Robinson, and she's never been seen since. Robinson was investigated as a suspect, but charges were never filed. Catherine Clampett's family did receive letters from Catherine, supposedly, but once again, they didn't believe it. And police at this point did have suspicions about John Robinson, but they couldn't prove anything. The letters were suspicious, but also people do leave like that, and they couldn't say with certainty that the letters weren't legitimate. Because even though they were typewritten, they did have signatures at the bottom. And as I've mentioned earlier, John Robinson was charming. He was a practiced liar and fooled a lot of people in his life. But in 1987, he finally went to prison. Not for murder, for more fraud and parole violations. He got a job working in the prison library, which was where he met 49-year-old Beverly Bonner, the prison librarian, who was married to the prison doctor. And John started an affair with her while he was an inmate. And after he was released, Beverly left the prison, divorced her husband, and moved to Kansas to work with John. She basically left her family to become John Robinson's girlfriend. Through the divorce arrangements, she would be getting about $1,000 a month, and somewhere along the line, she disappeared, and Robinson continued collecting her alimony checks. Later, members of Beverly's family began receiving Christmas letters from her that said she was traveling the world and having a great time. But John didn't stop there, because that was right around the time that the internet was first available, and John had 5 computers. The internet changed everything for John Robinson. It gave him a brand new, very dangerous weapon. He had the BDSM subculture to be his hunting ground. Investigators believed he was the first serial killer to use the internet in this way. John began speaking to women in online chat rooms under the handle Slave Master, looking for women who enjoyed playing the submissive partner role during sex. Authorities determined several of his victims engaged in sadomasochistic sex and participated in master-slave relationships with Robinson just before he killed them. An early online correspondent was 45-year-old Sheila Faith, whose 15-year-old daughter, Debbie Faith, was a wheelchair user due to spina bifida. They had a little over $1,000 to live on from the government, plus food stamps. They were in a pretty desperate spot when John invited them out to his farm, telling Sheila he would take care of her and Debbie. John portrayed himself as a wealthy businessman and philanthropist who offered to pay for Debbie's medical expenses and give Sheila a job. In 1994, the mother and daughter moved from Fullerton, California to Kansas City and immediately disappeared. Even after Sheila disappeared, her pension checks kept coming in. John pulled somewhere around $80,000 out of that mailbox over the next few years, all the while sending letters and emails from these women to their families, and some of the families never contacted police. Robinson became well known in increasingly popular BDSM chat rooms, and in 1999, he offered a job and a bondage relationship to Isabella Levicka, a 21-year-old Polish immigrant living in Indiana. When she moved to Kansas City, Robinson gave her an engagement ring, despite still being married himself, and brought her to the county registrar, where they paid for a marriage license that was never picked up. It's somewhat unclear whether Isabella believed she and Robinson were actually married. She had told her parents that she had gotten married, but never told them her husband's name. She also signed a 115-item slave contract that gave Robinson almost total control over every aspect of her life, including her bank accounts. And in 1999, Isabella disappeared. John told a web designer he employed that she had been caught smoking marijuana and was deported. Not long after, in March of 2000, John met 27-year-old Suzette Troughton online. And not long after, she moved from Michigan to Kansas to be with John. John was very easily able to scam her to come to Kansas City to be a caretaker for his elderly father, who had been dead for many years. He also told her he was a wealthy businessman who was going to take care of her, if she was his slave. They would travel all the time and go to exotic places. And she did visit Kansas 3 times before actually committing to moving there. But once she finally did, he picked her up from the airport in a limousine and put her up in the guesthouse apartment hotel. Suzette was very close to her mother, and within a few days, when she stopped contacting her and responding, her mother became extremely worried. In February, after only a few months of living there, Carolyn spoke to a Detroit reporter, telling them her daughter's emails were strange. Things weren't worded the way she would word them, and everything was spelled right, which was not how Suzette would have written them. She was worried enough about her daughter to make a phone call to the police department. Within 3 or 4 days, they had a task force up and running. Suzette Troughton had 2 Pekingese dogs, Pika and Harry, who she was very close to. She didn't go anywhere without these dogs. And Carolyn told investigators if they found Pika and Harry and Suzette was not around, something very serious had happened to Suzette. She wouldn't have gone anywhere without these dogs. So investigators set their sights on finding Pika and Harry. The day Suzette went missing, there was a discovery at the trailer park where John Robinson lived. There were 2 Pekingese dogs that were abandoned, and animal control was called. They came and took the dogs, and detectives went to one of the families that had adopted one of these Pekingese dogs to find out if they were Suzette's. The detective said, "Pika, come," and the dog's ears perked up, and it came running over, and its tail started wagging. It was Suzette's dog, and the investigators knew Suzette was probably dead. 2 detectives from Kansas went to John Robinson's old parole officer, Steve Hames, and asked if he remembered a man named John Robinson. And Steve bent over and opened the bottom drawer of his desk and pulled out a massive, thick file and plopped it on the desk in front of him and said, "Yeah, I remember John." Over time, Robinson had become increasingly careless, and his ability to avoid detection declined. By 1999, he had attracted the attention of authorities in Kansas and Missouri, as his name frequently came up in missing persons investigations. Carolyn Troughton and investigators were very confident that John Robinson was behind Suzette's disappearance, and so Carolyn decided to get John Robinson on the phone herself. In April of 2000, Carolyn called John Robinson while the line was being recorded by investigators. Suzette had left John's number with her mother, so she had access to it. And John told Carolyn he hadn't heard from Suzette in a while. She didn't take the job and had left with somebody else. She had left him a little postcard saying that she was off on an adventure. Carolyn told John, "She always calls me, and I'm very worried." And he told her, "Well, from what I understand, she's on a boat somewhere, so it's very hard to call." When Carolyn mentioned contacting the police about this, John really started turning on the charm. He started calling her hun, telling her she really didn't have to worry, and when they reached their next destination, he was sure that she would call or write. He had an answer for every question she asked and didn't skip a beat. And sure enough, a little while after that, Suzette's family started receiving letters, some from Kansas City, some from California. Relatives would even get birthday cards from Suzette. But her family knew this wasn't how Suzette would write. In one of the letters, her dog's names were misspelled, and that was a dead giveaway. Her mother said that Suzette was known for spelling errors, but she would have never misspelled her dog's names. Those were her babies. John Robinson's thing was he would apparently tell these women he was an extremely wealthy businessman and would take them on trips on his yacht. And because they'd be traveling so much and be so busy, they should write some letters home. So a few of the letters, the women actually wrote themselves, and he'd also get them to sign blank sheets of paper at the bottom so that he could then write a letter and have their actual signature on the bottom. As a part of the investigation, investigators started pulling John's trash, and in one of those trash bags, they had nothing but shredded documents. So investigators set up tables where they had people assigned to just putting the shredded papers back together. And one of those documents was for a storage locker in Raymore, Missouri. So they started surveilling that storage unit very closely. They wanted to catch John going in and out and figure out what was inside. As this investigation was actively going on, John was still bringing more women from all over the country and putting them up in hotels. And it was very nerve-wracking for investigators when women would come into town, because they were following him and they knew where he was going and who he was with. And when he would put them up in a hotel, investigators would rent the adjoining hotel room and listen in, which couldn't have been fun. They always had a fear that something would go wrong, and they had a dedicated plan for if John drove one of these women down to his farm, because they were terrified he would take them down there and kill them. And toward the end of the investigation, they learned that there was a young woman he was trying to lure down to his farm, and that was when they decided it was time to pull the plug. They had enough on him to arrest him and to get a search warrant, which was what they needed. A woman filed a sexual battery complaint against him, and another charged him with stealing her sex toys. So the theft charge finally gave investigators the probable cause they needed to obtain search warrants. June 2nd of 2000, 56-year-old John Robinson was taken into custody from the Santa Barbara Estates mobile home park where he lived with his wife. Two detectives went up to the door and knocked and asked to speak with him and his wife. And a few minutes later, he was taken out in handcuffs. He was accused of 2 counts of aggravated sexual battery and taking more than $500 in sex toys, with more charges to come. They arrested him and escorted him into questioning, and when investigators showed him some photos and things they had already compiled, his face lost color and he started getting very nervous. And that was when he called a lawyer, because it became very clear to John that this wasn't just about these 2 counts of aggravated sexual battery and the sex toys. This was about murders he had committed. Investigators knew that John Robinson had killed many women at that point, but they didn't have enough to convict him. They had to build a case very fast. Because John Robinson had gotten himself out of a lot of really difficult situations in the past, and they couldn't let that happen again. They knew they had to find those bodies, because if they didn't, he would most likely get away with it once again. They had a lot of information that led them toward the assumption that John had killed them, but they didn't have any physical evidence yet. But John owned 16 acres in Linn County, and it was in the middle of nowhere. And through their surveillance of phone records, they were able to determine that on March 1st, he had been down to his farm, which was the day that Suzette went missing. They searched the entire area with dogs. At noon, after a break and finding nothing, one of the cadaver dogs had signaled by some trash. Outside the trailer was a little shed, and next to the shed were some barrels tucked underneath some trees. As one of the investigators moved one of these barrels out, it fell on its side, and as soon as it hit the ground, a thin line of red liquid came dripping down the side, and then a fly landed on it. They immediately knew that this was blood. Once they opened the barrels, they saw who they believed to be Suzette Troughton. In the second barrel was another body, who they believed was Isabella Levicka. Across the state line in Missouri, investigators searched a storage facility where Robinson rented 2 garages, and they found 3 similar chemical drums containing corpses, who were identified as Bonner, Faith, and Faith's daughter. All 5 women were killed in the exact same way, by 1 or more blows to the head with a blunt instrument. The barrels in the storage unit were in the beginning stages of disintegration, but he had put down kitty litter to absorb the liquid that was leaching out, and to soak up some of the smell. But the barrels had obviously been there for a while. John didn't get rid of the evidence, most likely to relive his crimes. Following the discovery of these bodies, investigators executed a number of searches at John Robinson's house and office. And in his office in his home, they found a photocopy of the Roadway Inn receipt from 1985 with the name Lisa Stassi and the room number on it. They were able to find blank letters with Suzette's name signed at the bottom, which were identical to the ones Suzette's family had been receiving. They also found photocopies of the letters he had already sent to all of the families. So everything was falling into place. But John's crimes not only shocked his neighbors, but also completely upended the life of his adopted niece, Heather Robinson. One of the most mind-blowing revelations of this whole case was finding out who had raised Heather and what their relationship to John was. Investigators had begun looking into the missing women from the 80s, Lisa Stassi being the first. And after killing Lisa Stassi, John Robinson took 4-month-old Tiffany and gave her to his own brother to adopt. After the body recovery, investigators received a tip through the DA's office from one of Heather's relatives that said Heather's father had adopted a girl back in the 80s. The night they learned about John's arrest, Heather's parents had gotten a call to let them know, and Heather, who was only 15, picked up the other line and hit mute so they didn't know she was listening in. They said John had been arrested, and they believed he may be connected to Heather's mother. After she got off the phone, her parents began freaking out. They were panicking, talking about how horrible this all was, saying, "How could he do this to us? We're going to jail." And Heather was understandably also very freaked out, because her life would never be the same. The Chicago FBI went to their home and received the time frame, gathered adoption papers, and things they could look into. The family did agree to go to the FBI office and give DNA samples and fingerprints. At first, they were only able to compare Heather's footprint with the baby footprint from the hospital, and then, through DNA, they were able to confirm that Heather was, in fact, baby Tiffany. After that, Heather read all she could about the arrest of John Robinson, and incredibly, at the age of 15, she learned her mother was killed by a serial killer, and that killer was her Uncle John, who took her and gave her to his own brother, Don. John created an entirely different history for Heather. He had given her the name Heather and said she was born on October 12, 1984, when in reality she was born on September 3rd. The first time she celebrated her September birthday was her sweet 16, which was extremely difficult for her because she loved having her birthday in October since she loved Halloween. It was like she didn't know who she was anymore. She celebrated that birthday locked in her room crying, wishing she was dead. Heather was like the ultimate trophy for him. He got to see her year after year and watch her grow up. There was no legal adoption that had occurred. And there's a photo of John with the family where he's holding the baby on his lap, and that was the day that he brought Heather to them, which is an incredibly eerie picture because he's smiling from ear to ear with this baby on his lap. And as the viewer, you have no idea when this man murdered this baby's mother. It could have been hours before. And in a strange way, Heather almost felt a confirmation that the horrible vibe she always felt around her uncle wasn't from nothing. It was very real. She wasn't making it all up in her head. She said he, quote, gave me this really weird, off-putting feeling in the pit of my stomach. It's like walking down a dark alley in the middle of the night while you know someone is behind you, approaching you closer and closer. Heather always felt like her uncle was evil, even before she knew how to articulate it. It was just a gut feeling. And prior to him being arrested, when she was around 14 or 15, her family had gone down to Florida for one of John's kids' weddings. And while they were there, they were both on the dance floor. John pulled Heather to him and started grinding on her. He then asked her if she had ever had sex before, if it hurt, if she liked it. And he told her things were really rough between her mother and her father, so she could message him. Don't tell anyone, but he would send her a plane ticket and she could come out there to live with him, and they could get things situated and settled for her. And then they would go from there. This was a month before John was caught, and Heather was considering asking him for that plane ticket. She was thinking she was going to go down to Florida. And had John not been caught and she accepted this plane ticket, Heather is certain that she would also be dead in a barrel. At the time John brought Heather to the family, Don and his wife had been trying for kids for at least 5 years, and it never happened for them, which was when they started looking into adoption. They let their family know they were looking to adopt a child, and John told them he knew a lawyer that did adoption work, and he thought he could help them out. The last time police believe Lisa Stassi was alive was going into the Roadway Inn. They also thought it was highly possible that baby Tiffany was in the room when Lisa was killed. She was likely bludgeoned to death the day Heather was handed over to Don. John called Don and said his connection knew of a woman who had killed herself in a hotel room, and now they had this baby, so he could just come down and adopt her. The next day, Don and his wife were there to get Heather. And that's where the picture of John holding the baby on his knee with a big smile and the family around him came from. Don and his wife never met this adoption lawyer, but John had the paperwork and they signed it. As far as the actual adoption papers went, Don said they looked perfectly legal. John told his brother it would be $5,500 in adoption fees and provided a bunch of fake paperwork, including a certificate of adoption from a local court. Don did know that his brother was an excellent forger, but he didn't think for one second that this adoption was fake. Investigators were skeptical about Don at first. They thought it was entirely likely he knew more than he was letting on. But after looking into him more, it became clear to investigators that John's brother was also a victim in all of this. And after the information of all of this came out, they weren't sure what to do with 15-year-old Heather. The question of where she should go was considered. Should she stay with her adoptive family, or should custody be given to her biological family? They were very excited that she was alive and wanted to see her. Carl Stassi, Heather's biological father, was still alive and was very vocal about Heather being his daughter and wanting to see her. He was angry. He believed he had every right to see her and be in her life. But Lisa Stassi's side of the family believed they should do what was best for Heather. They, of course, wanted to see her and know she was safe, but if she didn't want to be in their lives, they were okay with that. If she was happy, that was all that mattered to them. They didn't want to take her away from her adoptive family. It was the only family she had ever known. They just wanted her to know that they were her biological family. And after that, the ball would be in her court. Heather's adoptive family was, of course, also devastated and didn't want to have their daughter taken away from them, so they were being extremely protective of Heather. Heather said the only biological family she's had anything to do with was Lisa's, specifically Lisa's mother. Heather was thrilled to be reunited with her biological grandmother. She taught Heather to not have hate in her heart and to forgive John, which she didn't fully understand at the time that her grandmother was alive, but after her grandmother's death, she said she understood. When asked if she wanted to know her biological father, she said no. She said inside she knew she had a dad and didn't want another one. Don wrote a letter to Carl Stassi, saying he really wanted to do what was best for his daughter, and he hopes they can all understand that and respect it. Heather wanted to know why Lisa was in a shelter. Why did she leave Carl? Which are very valid and understandable questions. And Carl never answered that letter. He never made any attempts to take her out of the Robinson home, so she stayed with them. In 2002, 18 years after the murder of Lisa Stassi, John Robinson stood trial in Kansas for the murders of Suzette Troughton, Isabella Levicka, and Lisa Stassi, along with multiple lesser charges. And he would be facing the death penalty. The courtroom was packed and very loud as everyone anxiously awaited the beginning of this trial. But as soon as John walked in, surrounded by deputies, it went silent. He seemed like an ordinary man. He was a very mild-mannered, unassuming guy. He walked into the courtroom in a suit and tie every day and just looked like someone's father and grandfather, which he was. But this case was massive. There were over 23,000 pages in police reports, and the prosecution ended up calling well over 100 witnesses. It ended up being the longest criminal trial in Kansas history. During the trial, there was also a lot of really disturbing information and things to see. One of which was a sex tape of John with Suzette, and they played it for the jury. They thought it was important for the jury to see his MO and the control he had over these women. The tape was 39 minutes long, and it was very graphic and explicit. Suzette was playing the role of the submissive to John, who was her master, who was very flat and cold in his commands to her. He kept telling her, "You're mine." It was obvious he liked being in control of these women. Many jurors turned their heads when they felt like they had seen enough. Throughout the duration of the trial, John had come off like a normal man at a business meeting, but when that tape was played, he sat up and was straining to get a better look. It was the only time he showed any kind of interest in what was going on. He was getting pleasure in reliving that. Meanwhile, his wife and daughter, Christy, were sitting right behind him and stood by him through it all. They sat there and listened to people talk about extremely explicit, violent details. And his wife just sat there stoically and listened. He had them fooled just like he had fooled everyone else. In a way, they were proof for how dangerous and manipulative he actually was. The prosecution took weeks to flesh out their case, and after they were finished, the defense only took half a day. The defense was more about saving him from the death penalty than trying to claim he was innocent. He obviously wasn't innocent. It took jurors less than a day to hand down a guilty verdict, and a few weeks later, the same jury delivered the death sentence. Robinson received two death sentences for the murders of Troughton and Levicka, and life imprisonment for Stassi's murder because she was killed before Kansas reinstated the death penalty. He received a 5 to 20 year prison sentence for interfering with parental custody of Lisa's baby, 20 years for kidnapping Troughton, and several months for theft. One of the jurors said they knew John was a con man and had conned Beverly Bonner while he was in prison, so they were afraid if they just gave him life, he'd still be able to cause harm. but he'd committed crimes in both Kansas and Missouri, so he had to face criminal charges in both states. After his trial wrapped up in Kansas, the case had to be tried in Missouri, and when it became clear that the women's remains would never be found without John's cooperation, a compromise was reached. They gave him a deal that if he pled guilty to the 5 murders, that he would avoid the death sentence. So he received a life sentence without the possibility of parole for each of the 5 murders that he committed in Missouri. They did want the death penalty in Missouri because Kansas hasn't executed anyone since 1965, whereas Missouri routinely carries out executions. So it was believed if he had been sentenced to death in Missouri, he would have likely been put to death and executed, whereas in Kansas, his appeals are still slowly moving along. But when all was said and done, he was found guilty of or admitted to murdering 8 women in Kansas and Missouri between 1985 and 2000. Though his true victim count is unknown. John is now 81 years old and has appealed his sentence on multiple occasions. In November of 2015, the Kansas Supreme Court threw out one of his capital murder convictions and one first-degree murder conviction, citing a double jeopardy situation in which he was tried twice for the same crime. However, the court ultimately upheld John's capital sentence. He filed a civil suit in 2016 and returned to court in 2022, hoping to earn a new trial or have his capital conviction vacated. Instead, he remains on death row at El Dorado Correctional Facility in Kansas. According to an online database operated by the Kansas Department of Corrections, John has had 4 disciplinary instances between 2016 and 2024, and this past November, he was reprimanded for theft. So he's still alive, but John spends his days in an 8x10 cell for 23 hours a day with nothing to do, which in a way is probably torturous for him, considering he was once a very busy con man. At least we can hope. Heather is now 40 and has a family of her own with her husband Roberto Ramos. As a part of Heather's journey, she went to Kansas City to meet some of Lisa's extended family. Heather didn't know her mother had a stepmom, and she met her for the first time. And after the camera stopped rolling, Heather received a letter, allegedly from Lisa, telling her that she was alive. One of Heather's family members pulled her aside and gave her this shocking information. She had been holding on to a couple of letters that she had received in 2009 and 2010 saying that Lisa was alive. Heather didn't think these were actually Lisa. She believed they were either from John or someone very close to him that were able to write them. But the letter she received from this family member was a 42-page typed letter from Lisa Stasi, the girl who apparently didn't type. So she immediately picked up the phone and called Steve Hayes. And Steve told Heather, no letters like this had ever been sent to other families. This was the longest and most in-depth they had seen. But that being said, Steve knew John Robinson's work better than anyone, and he took one look at this letter and said this was without a doubt John Robinson. He didn't even have to read the whole thing to know it. In the letter, it said, quote, Robinson helped me, he helped my daughter, and he helped his brother. I personally do not believe he is capable of harming anyone. I have seen this man, I believe I know him, and I have seen the lengths he will go to help others. The prosecutor and media have demonized him. A jury has put him on death row. I hope and pray that the details provided here will change that. This letter claimed she was still alive, but she begged her family member not to tell anyone because the letter would put her life in jeopardy. So the family member kept this letter a secret for 10 years because they didn't want to be responsible for Lisa getting hurt. So Heather took these letters to the DA. They had to figure out who had written them, because they were written and sent while John was already on death row. And that part of the story still remains a mystery. Steve Hayes said it was definitely from John Robinson, but if he was in prison, I don't know how he could have sent out a letter like that without it being flagged. So it may be possible that someone helped him, who is on the outside and was able to send this letter. But we don't know. Recently, a Lifetime movie about Heather Robinson was made and released called Kidnapped by My Killer, The Heather Robinson Story, which premiered on June 7th, 2025, so very recently. And although Lisa's body was never found, Heather said she will never stop trying to find her. But that is the story of John Robinson and Heather Robinson, aka Tiffany Stasi. But she goes by Heather now, because that's the only name she's ever known. I'm very glad that Heather's biological family didn't push harder to take Heather out of her adoptive family's home. Because legally, this adoption was never legitimate. So if they fought hard enough, they probably could have taken Heather away. But that would not have been the right thing to do in this situation. It's the only family she's ever known. And yes, this biological family loves her. And the knowledge that this baby that they loved so much is alive is not something small. But she was taken when she was only 4 months old. She was adopted into this other family when she was an infant. So I'm just glad that her biological family was as understanding and loving as they were. Her biological father making a ton of noise in the media and saying that she's his daughter and he has every right to know her and have her in his life, but then not answering the letter when she asked very understandable questions is a little strange. But it seems like Lisa's family wasn't in contact with him anyway, and they were doing the right thing and, you know, everything worked out. So a little bit of a hiccup in that situation, but ultimately everything turned out to be okay. But I can't imagine being 15 years old, almost 16 years old, and learning your adoption was fake, your name is not Heather, and your mother was murdered by your uncle, who you almost moved to live with. I can't imagine wrapping my head around that at any age, let alone being a teenager. Celebrating her 16th birthday in her room on her new birthday, which is her actual birthday, but to her, her new birthday, and having to come to terms with all of that. I mean, that is rough, but she did it and she continues to process it all and work through it and look for her mother's body. And I hope she finds it. It's really sad that Lisa's body was never recovered and a few of these women were never recovered. John Robinson is such an evil man and I hope he's having a terrible time and continues to have a terrible time until his very last breath. But I think that's all I have to say about that, so why don't we move on to a bit of a palate cleanser and I can tell you something good, that way we can move on with our days as normal. My good thing is that I am finally home after a very hectic couple of weeks of travel. The summer is insane because, you know, the weather's nice and everyone wants to go places and do things and see people, and that's very fun, and I feel very lucky that I got to travel so much, but oh my god, did I miss my bed and just being home. So I'm very happy to be here. And yeah, the first time I laid in my bed, I nearly shed a tear. It was like laying on a cloud, and that's a beautiful thing. As a girl with back problems, sleeping in other beds is not always a fun experience. So I just prefer my own, which I don't think is a crazy thing. I think most people probably prefer their own beds. And I'm back in mine, baby, so that's my good thing. But anyway, thank you all so much for listening. If you would like to check out all of our bonus episodes, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. Now that I'm back, I'm going to be getting back into the swing of posting YouTube videos, so check me out over on YouTube at Steph Today. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival or something crazy that's happened to you and you would like to share with us and possibly hear it on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. I post pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram at nottoday_podcast. You can find the link to our merch shop in my Instagram bio. We have a TikTok that is a day podcast and a Twitter that is a day podcast, but the TN of the podcast is a 3 because that makes sense. And just keep breathing. Yeah.